Our next item on the agenda is item number 8, and that's the Central Coast Long-Term Environmental Assessment Network. Mr. Briggs? We have some cards.
Thanks. Okay. Okay, thanks. Okay, so on today's agenda, we have these are the items that I suggested pulling off, and the board did pull off of not this item, but I suggested pulling the items off of the consent calendar that had to do with the permit reissuance for Carmel and Monterey Regional, and for sort of matching, I guess you'd say, monitoring and reporting program revisions for the Watsonville and Santa Cruz treatment plants. And they all participate in this monitoring program with acronym of CLEAN, and you just gave the entire name, so I won't repeat that. And of course, Karen Worcester is our CCAMP, Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program manager, and she has been working very carefully over the last, 6 years or so with the CLEAN program. We certainly want those programs to be compatible and to complement each other. And so today, as a prelude, a forerunner of consideration of those permit actions, Karen Worcester of our staff is going to be providing a summary of what we've learned from the CLEAN program and the direction that is recommended for changing the monitoring program and improving it as we go forward. And before Karen starts, I'll welcome our chair, Jeff Young.
Welcome.
So Karen Worcester of our staff.
Welcome, Chairman Young, and good afternoon, members of the board. I'm going to be talking a bit about CLEAN today before you consider approving the orders, items 9, 10, 11, and 12. And so I'm going to quickly go over some of the findings we talked about over a year ago now from the CLEAN's five-year program, and briefly review some of their work since then. Briefly, a timeline of CLEAN events, and this is more or less in the order I'm going to be discussing these today. CLEAN started up back in 2001, and I'm going to talk about the program's origins a little bit and a little bit about the five-year findings. As I mentioned, we went over the findings in detail in fall 2006, so I'm going to be brief, but to remind you of some of the key findings of the program. In spring 2007, the program went through a peer review with a very respected monitoring expert, Dr. Brock Bernstein. They spent quite a bit of time thinking about the peer review and thinking about where they wanted to go in the coming 5 years, and it came up with a draft plan in fall 2007. Today we're going to be talking about adoption of monitoring reporting programs that address a number of the elements of that plan, and then we'll also talk about required revisions to their quality assurance project plan, which basically details the technical components of their program. CLEAN was developed originally as an alternative and regionalized approach to the more traditional receiving water monitoring programs that the four treatment facilities listed here had in place. That's Santa Cruz, Watsonville, Monterey Regional, and Carmel area. These five entities, including the Moss Landing Power Plant, represent CLEAN as it is currently configured. And I think we have members of all of these entities present in the room today, as well as the program director, Dane Harden. CLEAN originally set objectives basically to measure the loads of pollutants coming off of the land from rivers and streams as well as from the discharges, to measure the effects of those pollutants in the marine environment, to document status and trends of the pollutants and beneficial uses, to produce high-quality science that is compatible with the state's surface water ambient monitoring program. Their basic approach, one of the key components was they placed 30-day flow integrating samplers. They're basically high-volume samplers that integrate flow over a long period of time in the river mouths, four major river mouths, the major discharges, and then out in the nearshore environment so that they could get very low detection limits and look for a number of pollutants coming from those various sources. They also had a stream monitoring component that did grab sampling at an additional 14 streams in the area. They looked at sediment monitoring along the 80-meter contour in Monterey Bay, which is where the fines tend to accumulate. And they also looked at mussel tissue around the edge of the bay to see how mussels were being affected by the pollutants of concern. I'm going to show you this map several times, so there's a lot on it, but I'm going to point out some of the major features, and you'll see it again. The main discharges are here in red, and these clusters of red dots are where some of the bacterial monitoring occurs. So you can see the main discharges. These are the river mouths that are monitored, Carmel, Salinas, Pajaro, and San Lorenzo. These are mussel monitoring sites, these diamonds starting at Scott Creek, Laguna Creek. This is the Hook. There's several more down in here. And there are other sites collected by other programs that are not shown here. That data is also available through like the NOAA Status and Trends program to look at tissue around the edge of the bay. There are sediment sites. These were considered reference sites up here. And these were considered depositional sites off the major rivers. These are at the 80-meter contour I mentioned. And then the two nearshore flow integrating devices, well, not flow, but they're time integrating 30-day sampling devices are here and here, and that's 4 to 5 miles offshore. This is just a graphic of these high-volume sampling devices I'll talk about today. Basically, a sampler is sampling in proportion to the flow, so as flows in the rivers come up, it's taking more sampling more frequently. The sample is running through a filter and through a column that's packed with resin beads. The organic pollutants adhere to the beads, and that's basically the sampling design. It samples over, as I mentioned, a long time, and that allows it to get very low detection limits for chemicals that you often aren't able to detect readily in water with grab samples. Briefly, some of the five-year findings. In general, we found higher, for all pollutants, have higher levels of persistent organic pollutants, POPs, in loads from rivers than from the treatment plant discharges. The highest loads were from the two largest watersheds, the Pajaro and Salinas rivers, and they tended to be the highest highest loading during the wet season. This is an example of one of the pollutants that we looked at. This is dialdrin, again, one of the organochlorine pollutants that are still persistent in the environment. What you're seeing here is a bar that's the cumulative sum of all the rivers loads over the program and the cumulative sum of the wastewater loads. The orange is the Salinas River. The green is the Pajaro River. You can see they by far dominate the loading from the river systems. You don't like my... Yes.
Is this on?
There we go.
You mentioned that still persists. How long has this been outlawed?
These were banned in the 70s.
So the same time frame as DDT?
DDT, yeah. It's in the same class of chemicals. It's a lot of, you know, we're still detecting this ubiquitously.
Another question about that. These are in the water column. You're not digging up or disturbing sediment to sample from there. So this
right.
is because we often think about old sort of legacy, if you want to call that legacy pesticides and POPs as being in sediments, but here you're actually getting them in the water column.
Right, but the filter I showed you on the sampling device, we would also look at the concentrations that are filtered off initially. So when you have high flows in rivers in particular, you get a lot of suspended sediments. So that's included in this. And you're right that this does tend to attach to sediments, which may be one reason we see so much more in the rivers.
But what's disturbing to me is the thesis that if they sat undisturbed in sediments, over time, these would get buried, even at the bottom of riverbanks and so on, and we wouldn't have to worry about them as much. But high flows stir them up over and over again, so that's even more disturbing. Yeah,
it is disturbing. In terms of looking at effects of those pollutants, the SeaClean program showed that mussels along the edge of the bay did show high levels of POP concentrations and no significant declining trends compared to past historical data. The same was true for sediments, elevated levels of POP concentrations, no declining trends. And there was some evidence that several benthic species could be being affected by those sediments, either that or just by the sediment itself. Also, the near-shore sampling devices did show that bay waters exceed ocean plan limits for some POPs most of the time. This is a complicated graph. I'll spend just a minute on it here. Each of these groupings of bars is individual sampling events, a particular site going from north at Scott Creek to Carmel. This is the mussel data. And this is each individual sampling events for that site. And then this is a number of screening or evaluation levels for dieldrin in tissue. This is for subsistence fisheries, recreational fisheries. These EDLs are State Mussel Watch elevated data levels at 85 percentile and 95 percentile. That's basically for 95, that would be 95% of the mussels that program has sampled fall under that value. So it's relatively high, in other words. And then OEHA is Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment Screening Value for Human Health. So you can see that for pretty much all of the sites violate some criteria or screening level. But the sites at Laguna Creek and the Hook tended to have higher values overall. And I wanted to go back to that map and just again remind you where those sites are. They're up in this area, which is kind of counterintuitive because the main rivers that had the large loads are down in this area. There is a lot of work being done right now in the bay looking at currents, nearshore currents, with regard actually to nitrate and whether the nitrate moving up current, because they seem to see phytoplankton blooms spinning out of this area, but the same could be true for pollutant movement in the bay as well. Back?
Yeah, back one, if you could.
I don't remember how.
One more. Is there a, does it look like there's a correlation with especially big storm events?
Yes, there's a seasonal pattern here. I was going to mention that, and I forgot.
Thanks.
What you're seeing is, in fact, I wanted to mention this because I'm going to touch on it later, wet season, dry season, wet season, dry season, wet season, dry season. So there definitely is a seasonal pattern with highest concentrations pretty much consistently during the wet season, which is implying suspended sediments coming out of rivers, potentially, or runoff.
Karen, is the upper standard, the US EPA recreational fishers, would that apply to the average person going to collect mussels along the beach to sport harvest?
Presumably, yeah, meaning lower use than subsistence, probably,
right,
which is why they're setting a lower
right
value for subsistence. DDTs and sediments, I'm just giving you a sampling of the data. We have a lot of different chemicals that the program looked at, but again, I think I showed you the sites from north to south at the 80-meter contour, and these are arranged that way from left to right. So these were our, quote, reference sites to the north and then the in-bay sites. And you can see they actually decline in concentrations as they get closer to the southern end of the bay, again, sort of supporting that idea that the pollutants are moving north. But this value down here is the average 2002 concentration of DDTs in San Francisco Bay sediment. So our sediments are comprehensively consistently over the levels in San Francisco Bay. And the NOAA ERL is an effects range low. That's a level set below which they don't believe there are any significant negative effects. Again, just to remind you, these were the four sites that were the reference sites. And then this was the highest one, I think, going lower in concentration, going that way. PCBs in Baywater, this was, this data I think is kind of unusual actually to have sampling of ambient bay water. It's just not done very often. And this is PCBs, that is the Ocean Plan 30-day average, and you can see that in all but one of the measurements that were taken, it exceeded that 30-day average. This is 4 to 5 miles offshore. And not necessarily seeing a seasonality there. We don't have as much data for this, but maybe. Again, just reminding you where those sites are. They're the stars right here, the north one and the south one. Okay, and then some other five-year findings. The nitrate and urea loads were higher from rivers than from the discharges, whereas ammonia and orthophosphate tended to be higher from the discharges in total. It should be noted that most of the marine research seems to be really focused right now on urea and nitrate in terms of phytoplankton bloom stimulus. So less so orthophosphate tends not to be limiting in the ocean environment. Also, in a Proposition 13 study that SeaClean partnered on with some fish and game and UC Davis researchers, they found that several chemicals, these were some chlordanes, PCB congeners, and PBDE congeners, were associated with higher levels of disease in sea otters. And there's still work being done on that data, but there were preliminary results looked like there was a relationship with higher levels of disease. And also, SeaClean began sampling. Let me PBDE, just to define that. I think you all know PCBs, but PBDE is what we consider an emerging contaminant. It's used as a flame retardant in fabrics, for instance, and I think it's common in electronics equipment. And it's showing up a lot now, suddenly, and we did find it, as I mentioned, high levels, or this project found it high levels in sea otter tissue, or elevated levels. We don't know what high is. But SeaClean decided to start sampling last year for PBDE in their discharges, and they did find loads in the discharges that looked preliminarily like they might be exceeding the loads from the rivers.
How is that getting into the environment? Do we know?
It actually can volatilize and off of furniture, you know, that scum that's on your car windows and new cars and all that. But I don't know how it's getting into the discharges.
Well, Karen, you said that we absorb it in our bodies and then...
Right, but how are we getting it?
House dust.
It's in the air. It's
dust.
Carpets, furniture.
Your foam pillows and foam cushions on your sofas.
Stereos, TVs.
It's everywhere.
Coffee makers, anything that has plastic in it, it's associated with an electronic device that may catch on fire. UL ratings, they have fire retardant.
So it's from the normal expected use of these plastic products and not from people illegally dumping it somewhere and having it degrade.
Airplanes presumably have the highest levels, but then people spend a lot of time on planes, presumably ingest more of this than other.
Oh, it's wonderful news.
Another thing to worry about at night. And it's an endocrine disruptor.
And maybe other things that we just don't know about.
Yeah. Okay, moving on, although Dana's here, so if you have other questions about the technical findings, I'm sure he can also help address those. So Dr. Bernstein peer-reviewed the program, and he basically was to address these questions. Has the program met its objectives? Was the study design adequate to meet its objectives? Are the objectives still relevant? And are the user's information needs being met? And he undertook this by he evaluated the data management approach of the program. He looked at the quality assurance documents and methodologies. He interviewed all the program participants, reviewed reports, and interviewed some technical experts on specific components of the program.
Is he an independent consultant?
Yes, he's a consultant. He said in Southern California, he's worked a lot with Southern California Coastal Water Research Program.
Right,
but
I saw that in the staff report. But is he connected with a university, a college program?
No. He's an independent consultant.
Yeah.
He's consulted on the SWAP program extensively as well. So.
Okay.
He was on a peer review panel for our program as well. So he had a number of recommendations. He had some for improving monitoring efficiency related to streamlining and combining program elements. I'll touch on those in a bit. Better standardization of the data management approach, and CLEAN is working on that with the SWAMP program because SWAMP is developing some methods to move data into their system, and so CLEAN has been meeting with that program to make sure that that's an integrated system. He suggested expanding the data analysis approaches. Some of this just comes with having more trend data and beginning to look more at long-term trends, but some other suggestions for ways to view the data. He thought that the program could use a different reporting strategy that would be more streamlined each year and then with one large comprehensive report periodically, sort of to avoid the phone book approach every year. He strongly recommended expanding relationships with other programs to grow the program and reevaluating the program objectives. And this was partly because CLEAN has addressed some of the program objectives, and in some cases the program objectives could change in consideration of new partners. So you might want to adjust the questions and objectives as you bring new partners into the program. And then finally, he thought that potentially some of the objectives might be a little too broad. An example of that would be the status and trends question. In nearshore waters, the sediment sites do a really good job of doing like trend monitoring over time, but he said if you were to want to understand the status of the entire bay, you would probably choose a different study design, like a randomized approach. So he was just suggesting that those kinds of issues be considered in reevaluating these objectives, which the program has done to some extent, but will continue to do as it is in dialogue with potential partners and over the next year or so. The CLEAN committee spent quite a bit of time thinking about the peer review and thinking about what they wanted out of the program in the future. It's very important that the costs remain reasonable. One of the discharges is quite small. Several are trying to reduce discharge to the ocean through reclamation programs, so they really don't want the costs to be escalating. They really decided they wanted to focus on issues that are more directly related to wastewater discharges because they were looking at legacy pollutants more, which, you know, were typically applied to agricultural land, although they were also used in other environments. So they really felt that they wanted to shift focus away from the river and stream monitoring and more towards new pollutants that were of concern to their own facilities. Mm-hmm. But they strongly wanted to actually want to maintain the existing objectives that are broad, but partner with other programs as a way to expand monitoring capacity.
How did the board get them in the beginning to agree to look at contaminants that were not coming from their discharge?
The CLEAN committee was very interested. Well, number one, they didn't think that they were responsible for the bulk of the loads of a lot of these pollutants. And they were agreeable to doing this because, in fact, it did show that the rivers are the main source of many of these contaminants. So from that standpoint, it's been very valuable for them. And they really like that program component, but they are not discharging to the rivers.
Right.
So this is where they would like their program to go now. They would like to keep those components going, but they feel that other discharges, the sources, should be contributing to picking up that kind of monitoring.
Did the board have some data prior to the creation of C-Clean, which suggested there was these other contaminants in the environment that may be connected to the discharges from the treatment plants?
You know, I don't know the whether the treatment plants themselves were sources. I think a lot of these contaminants, when grab sampling, don't really show up very well. So one idea was to get the detection limits down so we actually measure it.
One of the main ideas initially was simply to integrate receiving water monitoring, mm-hmm. because what we had before with the five dischargers was, in addition to the influent effluent monitoring, we had receiving water monitoring programs which had concentrated monitoring in the vicinity of the outfall, maybe a couple of control stations that weren't too far away, and it wasn't giving us any kind of an integrated picture of what's happening in the in this receiving water that they share. So I think that was one of the main ideas, was to say, how can we cooperate and come up with a monitoring program that makes more sense for the entire receiving water?
Right, and they actually, this question, in the course of deciding how to do that, this question came of interest, is, well, how do we compare to other large sources of discharge? So after considering the peer review and where they wanted to go with the program, C-Clean put together a draft five-year plan, and the primary recommendations are, first of all, to reduce muscle monitoring frequency to once per year. That would be during the wet season when it's highest, and it makes it consistent with, like, the federal program, the NOAA Status and Trends program, which we're using the data from. So they felt that was a reasonable way to streamline costs. To eliminate the river sampling component, however, I want to add here that both the city of Watsonville and the city of Santa Cruz intend to maintain those devices in the rivers adjacent to their urban areas, just because they feel that that data is very valuable for them to manage their urban runoff as well. So that's San Lorenzo and Pajaro rivers. To rely on CCAMP for the stream grab sampling, we are already, our coastal confluence program samples most of the streams they were, and we've just added a few additional analytes. And so that was a good cooperative solution, I think. To add several pollutants of emerging concern, and right now we're talking about PBDE and perfluorinated compounds. Perfluorinated compounds are in Teflon and Scotchgard, and they line the insides of drink cups. And it's another emerging contaminant that showed up in sea otter tissue, potentially associated with higher levels of disease.
It's in drinking cups, so we're drinking
it? It's that waxy coating on the insides of cups.
On the inside, okay. Mm-hmm.
I think there's discussions of phasing it out. Okay. They're going to be considering some revisions, whether they want to revise some of their high-volume sampling methods or not. There's pros and cons to several different methods. And some have, for example, are better for polar compounds versus nonpolar. And one reason they want to do this is they are including their table B pollutants from their effluent requirements, using this methodology to do that sampling. And the advantage of this will be lower detection limits for those compounds. They also want to, or are, expanding to include discharges from the areas of special biological significance. Dane Harden's been very involved in dialogues with those dischargers as to how they might regionalize their monitoring approach to address state board requirements. The five-year plan recommended that funding should be found to continue Salinas River monitoring at the least. It's considered a really important piece of information. And then they're also considering revising the sediment sampling program based on external review they're currently undertaking right now. So the monitoring reporting programs for the four treatment plants reflect these recommendations. First of all, they continue to have the monthly grab sampling for nutrients and nitrate, urea, silica, and orthophosphate. And now we're proposing high-volume water sampling of Table B compounds and other priority pollutants where it's appropriate. Also, in terms of other monitoring requirements, the MRPs require participation in CLEAN. They require that a revised QAPP, the Quality Assurance Plan, be submitted by July 1st. And it also includes a summary table of the basic CLEAN program components. Actually, it's just been updated. The table's been in the MRP, but it's been updated with some of the new program components. Finally, to update the Quality Assurance Plan, they need to basically clarify the study design for addition of these new program components, the analytes they're going to measure, the specific methods and method quality objectives. And they're going to do that for the high-volume water sampling, for bioassays for endocrine disruption to screen for that in discharges, and for perfluorinated compounds and PBDEs. And they'll also be responding to some of the technical issues in the peer review there. So basically, should you adopt items 9, 10, 11, and 12, the CLEAN revisions would include the elimination of river monitoring, streamlining of a few program components, but a new focus on emerging chemicals, evaluation of endocrine disruption in the discharge, and better detection of Table B compounds. And if you have questions, as I said, we have the full CLEAN steering committee behind me. So, thank you.
Yeah, do you think that that we as a board should be wanting to do something more about these chemicals in the environment in terms of regulation?
Yeah.
Okay. I read the conclusions on page 3 of the staff report, I just thought, okay, all these suggestions are in terms of how to refine the program and make changes to it, and I don't have a problem with that, but I'm concerned about what do we do as a regulatory agency that is supposed to be protecting beneficial uses, and we've got exceedances. I don't think we need to wait another 5 years.
You know, the exceedances, I just read an article that showed exceedances by some of the organochlorine chemicals in Sierra Lakes from aerial deposition. So, you know, from the standpoint of some of these chemicals are becoming so ubiquitous in the environment, we're finding exceedances in the Arctic, in relatively
pristine environments. Well, I know the flame retardant chemicals in the polar bears.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I don't think that means that we throw our hands up and say, well, the problem's too big for us to start to grapple with. And maybe this is the policy stuff that Dr. Press likes to grapple with in terms of, you know, is there something else we should be doing or asking in terms of a response to this data?
Yeah, but we don't have, it seems to me, we don't have the authority to, I mean, we can add, I suppose, we could consider TMDLs as an approach.
Mm-hmm. Or swamps.
Yeah. But the approach that other state agencies and the federal government is to really take a hard look at whether these compounds should be used at all. And
right.
I think what you're really reflecting on is that there's at a kind of more legislative level, people are talking about looking at phthalates and looking at endocrine disruptors and looking at P8 and these other compounds and saying, well, should these even be produced? And arguably, we do best with certain compounds, I want to stress, not every pollutant, but certain pollutants when we ban them outright. DDT, lead and gasoline, dioxin, some of those. So that seems to me that the effective approach, which is to ban the sale and production, both, is beyond the authority of this board.
But some of these compounds haven't been used for 20 plus years, and they're there. They're in our watershed. So that approach would work for some compounds, but not all of them.
Yeah, well, but what would you suggest as a way of dealing with these legacy ones?
I don't know. I just think, though, that we should at least discuss it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my question in answer to that would be to staff and to other interested parties. Are you suggesting that we act on those things or those in such ways as to prevent further movement of these compounds? I mean, you can't stop the rivers from high flow, but you can possibly do something to prevent sediment from being disrupted or disturbed more, I guess.
I was going to say, everything we do related to sediment movement, erosion control, detention basins, all LID stuff is directly related to that, because it's about the legacy chemicals are all about sediment.
Which would suggest to me that in our language and in our talking about sediment, we start to talk about sediment in a different way, a way that is beyond dirt, basically, and that would. That would, I think, signal even more to the public the gravity of sediment control. Because for a lot of the public, understandably, people say, well, why are you calling dirt a pollutant? And why are we seeing such heavy regulation for dirt? People don't associate dirt with pollution. They don't think of it as being a polluted item, polluted thing. They think of it as being soil. Especially if they call it soil. But if you start to say the sediment is actually also these other chemicals, then rhetorically and in the public imagination, that takes on a different importance. So maybe we should be talking about that differently, about sediment and its problems differently, since we already have, as Karen's pointed out, regulatory means of controlling sediment.
And we've done that a lot with the ag program, for example. As you were talking about the proclivity of pesticides to attach to sediment, so we've certainly emphasized that with the ag program as a, you know, one of the important factors of sediment control. It's not just dirt. It's
yeah.
It's that tends to have pesticides attached to it. Karen mentioned a couple of these emerging contaminants, and you mentioned that there's a move afoot to ban it, mm-hmm. and that happens. I mean, that basically happened with MTBE, for example.
Yeah. Well, this board and C-Clean, better than most state and regional agencies, provides data. Mm-hmm. That can be it can be an input to
right.
the political and legislative process, and so that's another thing to do with these data, is to say these should be
right.
these should be sent up to Sacramento, sent to Washington, and to other state agencies, and said, look, this is why we think an outright ban makes sense, not just because we're hysterical, but because here they are.
Right, so there's that aspect, and then there's also the aspect of source control for chemicals that are not about to be banned, such as pharmaceuticals and some personal care products, and we are working on trying to change people's habits as far as some of the sources that can be prevented. The source as far as passing through our bodies is a tough one, but there are folks who discard expired or for other reasons pharmaceuticals, and they might just throw it down the drain. So we're actually working on something for our website, and we're working with the state board on a coordinated basis to provide more information for people so that they know how to dispose of them properly. And as I was just saying recently, we've been able to get people to change their habits. It wasn't that long ago that people were not recycling plastic, and it wasn't that long ago that people weren't using the mutton mitts, you know, picking up after their pets. And we have changed people's habits, and I think this is another case with these pharmaceuticals where we're going to have to do the same, and we are working on that. And there's a lot of information actually out there already. Carol Hewitt was looking up some information on this topic in the last week, and on the San Luis Obispo County website, San Mateo has some good information that we're going to be using. And so it's coming up pretty rapidly in terms of awareness of it, and we're going to be pushing that as well. Integrated Waste Management Board has some money to actually pursue that, so we're going to be coordinating with them as well.
Well, I agree with what you say, and you know, it sounds like we're doing something.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to see staff come back with something else, and I'm just trying to picture what that is in terms of, you know, what are the chemicals that we really can't deal with because they're being produced today and really need to be on some kind of a list that we communicate out that are appearing in our environment in the Central Coast region and that should be dealt with legislatively.
Well, that suggests that we actually should be maybe even more aggressively asking our representatives to consider legislative approaches, which is not something we do a lot of. But
right. Well, we need to communicate this information to whoever can take it to the next step in terms of helping us with the contaminant problem in our environment. The other aspect of this is, what are the chemicals that are legacy, that are not being used, but are here, that the data suggest are not decreasing in the environment? Is there, you know, what is our strategy to deal with those? I mean, is our best strategy through our TMDLs, through our swamps, things of that nature? Because if it is, and, you know, I've been told by staff that swamps, that's our mechanism for doing a lot of things. You know, again, I'd like to see how we're really addressing this in our swamps, because, you know, we're allowing the MEP standard to be somewhat defined by the dischargers in terms of how they're going to comply. And I want to make sure that, you know, if we've got these chemicals present in a watershed where a swamp is discharging, then I just want to feel comfortable that we are trying to do something about it in terms of control. And I would think with the do our TMDLs, I guess they only deal with pollutants of concern based on the 303 D list?
303 D listing, right.
So a TMDL would not even deal with flame retardant in the environment.
Not yet. Once we start measuring, the problem is criteria, but if you can link it to a problem, you know, in other words, it's not enough to measure it.
Right.
You have to link it to a problem.
And you need a standard for it?
Well, there are ways around the standard. There's a weight of evidence approach.
Yeah.
There's just exceedance of a standard, that's kind of a slam dunk for listing. But if you have a weight of evidence that there's a problem, like it's showing up in sea otters with disease, for instance,
right,
or whatever, that would be part of a weight of evidence approach that you could potentially use.
Okay.
You know, PBDE, I think, has been banned in Europe. For the EU's,
a lot of this has been banned in Europe. The Americans are just incredibly slow with this.
Right.
It's unbelievable. It's appalling.
Chair Yun?
Yes. Dr. Hunter.
Thank you. I also would like to know more about the some of the recommendations out of the peer review analysis was talking about integrating with the Ocean Plan and some of the other programs in the state. And so I'd be curious to know What kind of guidance do we get from the Ocean Plan? How is that reflected in the work that we're doing? Is the Ocean Plan a feature of the evaluation that gets made whenever we're looking at an ocean discharge? And I understand that the Ocean Plan is undergoing review. There's some effort to revisit and reconsider ways in which
it's always under review. There's always a triennial review.
But I'm encouraged. I am encouraged because Jonathan Bishop was recently put into a new position at State Board, and that's one of his top priorities. So I think we might see some action coming out of it. But so I'm just curious, how's the integration with the Ocean Plan, and what guidance do we get, and how can we increase what we're doing, linking with ocean standards that the State Board is? My understanding is the Coastal Commission and the State Board, the regional boards, are the only ones that have real authority over water quality. So we should be taking the lead on this.
Karen, you want to try that, or you want me to touch on the Ocean Plan?
Do you
want
to try it first?
Yeah. Well, I think Karen might have been referring to some
Matt
other...
Matt Keeling of our
Yeah,
staff.
I'm sorry. My name is Matthew Keeling. And Karen's talking about these other standards. She may have been talking about other programs, like the stormwater programs, and how to integrate the river sampling to deal with the stormwater discharges and the agricultural issues. As far as the Ocean Plan goes, that is the standard that we have and that we use that establishes the criteria for a laundry list of priority pollutants and other domestic and industrial wastewater treatment related types of pollutants that governs how our MPDS permits for ocean discharges are crafted. And so that's the major guideline document that we use in developing the MPDS permits. And as you mentioned, it goes through a constant review. I think it's every 4 years. And so they're currently coming up on their next four-year review. And one of the things that they do is they go back and they look at all the different constituents that they have data for, and if the criteria that they have that's existing in the Ocean Plan has been updated, they will update that in the Ocean Plan. And then so our subsequent permits, the effluent limits will be revised accordingly. And as they find new constituents that are added to the list and that we have data for that they can establish either a human health or aquatic habitat type criteria, they add that into the Ocean Plan. And there's bacterial standards, monitoring standards. There's a whole list of different things that we have to apply to the MPS permits based on that.
So is it a two-way process? Are we giving them data and suggesting priorities or areas of concern that we are showing in our monitoring data throughout our region? Or is there any possibility that we could be more proactive in identifying some of the contaminants that we're seeing through these very effective and now somewhat long-term data sets, that we can say here's some areas where we can demonstrate, we can show that these are having an effect in the marine environment, and yet the Ocean Plan needs to catch up?
Yeah, there is an opportunity for us to do that because it has a public comment period and a review period that in some cases lasts a couple years, and they go over a lot of these issues. So we can have an opportunity to propose other constituents. Most of the information and the data that goes in there, the hard data for establishing the water quality objectives or the criteria, if you will, kind of trickles down more from the EPA level. But we can certainly make recommendations.
I would agree with that. I think we just need to make a list of what we want to just have followed up on with that. So more input into the Ocean Plan review. And I would like to see something, and this can obviously come back to us as a status report for discussion, but how, what is staff's approach to trying to deal with some of these long-term legacy compounds through our either TMDL program or our stormwater program? Or something else.
Okay.
Okay. And then something else that occurred to me is, and it's somewhat mentioned here, that you were going to collaborate with some of the southern region wastewater plants. Does that mean the Santa Barbara Channel or Morro
Bay? One idea is to use the high volume sampling approach in other ocean discharges to try to get a better handle on, because you really don't get as many non-detects. You're able to detect very low levels, as you can actually calculate loading. So the idea of looking at applying that technology in other ocean discharges.
Well, is there a way to look at, say, the Santa Barbara Channel, where you have five dischargers, that somehow there could be a similar Sea Clean program set up in the channel?
Yeah. We actually evaluated doing the rest of the region when we were starting Sea Clean, and at the time, both the Morro Bay plant and the Goleta plant had their 301H waivers and had fairly rigid monitoring requirements. And at that time, we didn't feel that we could, change the receiving water monitoring program to a more of a regionalized approach. And they were the bulk of the monitoring resources. When you looked at what was available to glue a program together, they were important pieces of that. So we didn't feel that we had the same capacity there. But I think with those plants changing to full secondary, there may be sort of a new opportunity now to do that.
Well, then they won't have to do as much marine monitoring.
But we'll have more.
The trade-off is
less and more flexibility, though, because with the 301H waivers, EPA was a primary driver as far as the monitoring programs.
Okay.
So now we'll have some more flexibility.
Well, I think it would be helpful to maybe look at that. for both the Morro Bay area and the Santa Barbara Channel, in terms of trying to create some type of a Sea Clean program in those regions.
I'll point out that it's not just an ocean discharge issue.
Oh, right. It's
this would be applicable to our. We don't have that many inland municipal dischargers, a handful, but it should be applicable there as well, because they end up running to the ocean, but then also you have groundwater recharge along the way, sometimes reuse of that water. So it's critical from that standpoint.
Dr. Hunter?
Thank you. One more point. In the report, there was mention that the program will expand to link in with ASBS monitoring. And since we have Dane Harden here, it would sure be nice to hear a few words about what's going to happen. Thought you might not have to come up to the podium. We really appreciate having you here, by the way.
My pleasure. Well, it's a work in progress, I'll say that. I have met with the Monterey Peninsula ASBS dischargers, and we have talked about developing a strategy for moving forward with a regional approach. And we're just really in the beginning phases of that, so we're sort of feeling each other out and who's going to work with whom and that sort of thing. So, like I said, it's a work in progress, but they recently they've shown a real interest and willingness to come to the table and talk about developing a regional approach. So,
what do you think is motivating that interest? Because I'm very happy to hear that, and if we can support and encourage that.
There is this guy at the state board, and his name is Dominic Gregorio, and he carries a big stick. So that's point blank. That's kind of what's motivating them at this point. Plus, there are ASBS dischargers who are very. Have come to the Sea Clean Steering Committee meetings, have kind of seen what the process is, and are very favorably disposed to the benefits of a regional approach. So they've been, from one side, trying to facilitate a dialogue, and then from the other side, you have Dominic telling them they need to do this. So
that's really good news. Thanks. Okay. So we'll look forward to hearing future developments.
I hope I can bring good news.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, any other board questions or comments? All right. Mr. Briggs, looks like we have just a recommendation.
Yeah, I wrote down a number of action items here.
Okay.
Did you want me to recap those?
Sure, go ahead.
Well, one was pursuing bans of chemicals that are showing up at problematic levels, and as Dr. Press was pointing out, that goes a little beyond our authority, but we do have opportunity for input, whether it's through the State Board, with the Office of Legislative Affairs, and working with legislators and with the administration. So that's not as outlandish as it sounds. And Mr. Chairman, you were talking about ensuring that our and by the way, you mentioned two different kinds of swamps in the same presentation here, which pretty exciting. And I'm sure it drives Mr. Hodgins crazy. So the first swamp that Karen was talking about is the surface water ambient monitoring program. The one you were talking about is the stormwater management.
Oh, the one I can't program. Get off my mind. No, not the one Karen's.
Anyway, for the stormwater ones, those swamps you were talking about, making sure that as those are getting revised now, as you know from the strategy that you approve for us pursuing this year, that we make sure that we do everything we can within those stormwater plans to address these emerging chemicals, and you asked for a status report back on our approach to especially the legacy compounds, and you mentioned any other programs that where that might be a factor, and I already mentioned the ag program for one. You mentioned TMDL program for another.
Right.
But as Karen was pointing out, there won't be a TMDL unless there's a listing, and we've got to have enough information as well as either criteria or weight of evidence to have a listing. I'm not sure that's the most effective way to go for a lot of these. You mentioned being, Dr. Hunter mentioned being proactive with the ocean plan update and providing our information. It is kind of not only emerging compounds, but emerging data. And so we should be making sure that the State Board staff and then the State Board benefit from this emerging information. Karen mentioned, in answer to your question, the expansion of the high-volume approach with other dischargers, not just southern ocean dischargers, but as I said, it's there's no reason it's not applicable. It should be applicable to inland dischargers as well. And you didn't mention this as a follow-up, but I think it does follow that we'll be providing you with updates on the ASBS issue in terms of the monitoring approach, whether it's regional or otherwise. The State Board is going to be in our region for its meeting on April 1st and 2nd. The second is going to include a field trip that will, the first stop is at the Hopkins Marine Station, and I know they have a straw proposal for monitoring, which I assume is part of this.
I don't know whether they're using the one I gave them or...
Okay. Like you say, you're in the beginning phases of talking about that. So anyway, we'll come back to the board with information as that develops.
So are all these going to come back at once or just in piecemeal?
Well, I think it would make sense to at least provide status on all of these at some point. I'm not.
Okay.
I don't think it makes sense to do that the next board meeting. We
no,
need
no,
some
no.
time to get these to gel a little bit. But
okay. How about maybe in the summer?
Yeah.
Summer board meeting. Okay.
That would be Watsonville at the new Watsonville City Council chambers. Where's Bob? There he is.
All right.
I just wanted to also comment that we're having a toxicity workshop, board workshop, in May. And I think a lot of the approaches that you'd use to address toxicity from particularly things like pyrethroids that are carried in sediment are very related to legacy pesticides. And we do have, you know, toxicity in our waters from currently applied pesticides. So I think that this is a similar mechanism, and I think we're going to be talking about approaches both in the ag and urban environment. So
this is part of the overall discussion. I mean, you're, Karen, are always involved in generating data, which is very interesting. And I just want to make sure that, you know, the board is kind of incorporating this into some plan that we've got an approach to do what we can about it and do the appropriate thing, whether just communicating these results outward or making sure that our own regulatory programs have some strategy to do something about it. So are we going to be getting an update on your toxicity workshop? Is that coming to the board?
Yeah, it's going to be a board workshop
in May.
May 8th, the day before the Friday board meeting.
Okay.
It's going to be probably from 10 to 4. We're just working on the agenda.
Okay.
It's going to have one component that's about, you know, framing the problem, but then one component on ag solutions and another component on urban solutions. So I think a lot of ideas could get generated there, is what I'm saying.
When you say board, is that board like a board meeting? Oh,
yeah, a board workshop.
I wasn't aware that we had a double date there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you're having a workshop before the board meeting, right? You're not talking about the board meeting itself having a status report on what you're going to be discussing, or are you?
We've been calling it a board workshop, like the sediment workshop that we had up. Is that? Roger, I'm looking at you.
I didn't know we were having a two-day meeting either. So you were thinking of the board being included in this workshop, not just...
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. You just mentioned 10 to 4 or something like that, and that's news to me. So.
Uh-oh. I guess we better work on that.
Okay. We do need to coordinate with the board.
Okay. We'll do that.
Okay. So we'll hear more about that, right? In the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, I hope to hear more about that.
I'll put that on my list.
Well, there was another point I forgot to write down because I was talking about it, but that would be to follow up on this, the pharmaceutical source control, personal care product source control initiative that I was talking about. So we can give you more information on how we're doing with that.
Okay.